Welcome to episode 15 of the Radio Live Transmission Podcast. I am your host. My name is Ryan. Thank you guys for listening. And I am very excited because I'm doing something a little bit that I haven't done yet on the podcast, which I've wanted to do, and that is talk about two albums by the same band. Surprisingly, I haven't done that yet, but welcoming back to the show today, a guy who's been on the podcast before, by the name of Tim Parrish. How's it going, Tim?
Good, Ryan. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Thank you. I figured you would be a good fit. You know, last time we talked about punk scene in Baton Rouge back in the 70s. That's it. Yeah, there we go. It makes sense to have you back for this episode. We're going to be talking about two albums from the Detroit post-punk band Proto Martyr. Their newest album, which came out on September 29th, and which is called Relatives in Descent, and their debut album from 2012, which is called No Passion, All Technique. Tim, why don't you just give listeners who maybe aren't familiar, you know, who didn't listen to the episode that we did about Louisiana punk scene in Baton Rouge, just give them a little bit of lowdown about your musical tastes and all that, just to sort of, you know, give them a refresher.
Sure. I was less in the punk scene myself than sort of beginning like mock rock, sort of subverting
right.
And making kind of pop send ups of new wave, but with some weirdness thrown in. And then I think what mostly interests or connects with what we're doing today is the second band I had was really a kind of post punk Americana band. Which Americana, meaning we were influenced a lot by country,
yeah,
and then some traditional punk rock like the Damned, and especially bands like the, in particular, Early X and the Replacements,
right,
were huge influences on me, as well as Husker Du, and I think some of those same influences are coming out, especially in Proto Martyr's first album, and I really like both these records, and. You know, as we'll talk about more, I think the fourth record in a lot of the ways is this distillation of a lot of the 80s. And the first album was not quite as integrated. Their influences weren't as integrated, but it still rocks like crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Proto Martyr was definitely an interesting find for me. I mean, I've always been a fan of post-punk and punk, and a fan of a lot of Americana as well. So I can't remember exactly, you know, which band I was checking out on iTunes or whatever music service it was when I, you know, found Proto Martyr in the sort of stuff you should listen to tab, you know, the recommended listens. I found their second album, an album that's called Under Color of Official Right, and wasn't immediately grabbed by it. You know, it sort of was a, okay, you know, I'll give this a chance, you know, but, you know, I didn't have too high of an expectation.
I thought
it
was an album by the British Navy.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So it's funny because that's happened a few times with bands, you know, recently. That have ended up becoming, you know, favorite bands of mine that I just want to listen to all the time. So I that's why I sort of have to give bands the benefit of the doubt when my initial impression is just kind of, I don't really get it.
Yeah.
But
well, you know, I mean, I'd never heard of them, and now,
yeah,
since I've done a little research, I find out they're darlings of the
right.
post post or post-post punk scene, as I saw somebody at the New York Times actually refer to them. And, you know, the first album is very approachable. I mean, it does veer a couple of times into what I would call punk rock, but most of the time a little more what I said earlier. But I didn't really have an immediate way into the fourth record. And it, I think, like you said, it took some repeated listenings before I started to get it. And again, it's a rocking album, but it's much more heavily produced and in some ways kind of more calculated. And I think, and surprisingly, I didn't hear this mentioned one time in the several reviews I read. It's got a lot of influence from industrial music in it, I believe. I think you said the same thing.
Yeah, I definitely I hear that, and it's I guess I can sort of understand why some people might miss that, you know, in reviews, because it's not, you know, it's not done in a way on this album that's you know, it's not overly used at all. You know, it's used very subtly, and it's just used in a way that enhances sort of the other layers, you know, the others.
Yeah, it's really well put,
More so than you know, your industrial acts, you know, your Nine Inch Nails and your Ministry and your all that kind of stuff. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not abrasive in the same way that
it is in bursts,
that a lot of those.
Like you're saying, yeah. It really, it embellishes and enhances. Yeah.
But that just goes, I mean, that's a, you know, using it like in that way to enhance the rest of the sound, really, you know, it just goes to show, you know, how much you can do with a little, you know, a little goes a long way.
Yeah, it's dynamics. I mean, that's really, especially the fourth record. And again, the fourth record is Relatives in Descent, which is a great title.
Yeah.
We all have some. Right. Or we are some.
Or we are some, yeah.
But, I totally forgot where that was going, but yeah, it's
okay.
Maybe at the end we'll
come back around.
We'll tell them the story of the podcast.
Right. Yeah. Right. Oh goodness. But, so why don't we go ahead and as far as relatives.
Well, I don't know what I was going to say.
Okay, go for it then.
Yeah, because I think it's important to set it up. This guy is a really interesting lyricist. And I don't say interesting there like on a freshman comp paper where I didn't want to say this is really bad. I would write interesting. Right. It's interesting and it's very good. The guy is definitely a literary writer. He at times seems heavily influenced by notions of absurdity. And but, you know, there's almost never a cliched phrase in here. If he hits something that's a cliche, he's using it for effect and putting it in the context of lyrics that completely jar it out of that cliche. He's not what I'd call a singer either, for the most part. Although his voice is really effective, and he talks a lot of his lyrics at times, even kind of touches on Craig Finn of the Hold Steady. It's really smart work.
Yeah,
and it meshes well with the band behind him.
Joe Casey is his name.
Yeah,
we'll say that now.
He's 10 years older than all the other guys in the band too.
I
appreciate the,
that's right.
The older thing.
Yeah, I didn't realize that actually. That's funny. Just from seeing pictures of them too, I wouldn't even say, oh, there's the Fogey, you know, in the band. Right? But that's funny. But yeah, he and it's one of the things that is funny to me about Proto Martyr is even after I've listened to whenever, you know, they release a new album, or, you know, in the case of when I was exploring their catalog, like, you know, just making my way to another album and trying to sort of wrap my head around it. Even after I would get a sense of the lyrics and the melodies and everything, I find that I don't sing along or vocalize along with this band all that much while I'm listening to them. It's funny.
Yeah.
There's parts where I do, but most of the time it's more of me just receiving,
right,
you know, the material. And I think that's interesting.
Well, as we talked about before, I'll try to stop saying that phrase since we basically talked about all this before.
Right.
Again, referring to the story we'll tell later. It's you know, a lot of the lyrics, even after I've read them, mm-hmm. I still don't remember. Because
yeah.
they're somewhat incomprehensible on the record, but then they're not, for the most part, narrative lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy can be verbose. So
yeah.
there are a lot of words.
Right.
And he's got strange phrasing too. And but it's one of those records too, if you do try to sing along with chants or choruses, and I don't mean chants like a Zen Buddhist chant, but he does effectively use these refrains.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, when you find out what the lyrics actually are, you'll get a laugh out of some of your misinterpretations. Like there's a bathroom on the right. And excuse me while I kiss this guy.
You beat me to it. Dude.
Yeah, so some things like that going on here that are interesting. So yeah, I don't think it's surprising that.
Right.
It's not a sing-along.
It's just kind of, yeah, you're just kind of, like I said, you're sort of trying to, it's like Joe Casey is he's throwing so much at the wall, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you're standing in front of the wall, and some of it's going to stick, and some of it's just going to go right by, some of it's just going to hit the floor, and you're not, you know, you're not going to catch it the first time. But that's great, because that means that, you know, you're going to keep going back, you know, to the record again and again and again, because you...
They weren't really what you'd call melodies. They aren't traditional melodies either.
No,
so.
Not really. No, it's
not your humming while you're driving.
It's very sparse, the melodies, and they're also unusual too.
Yes.
And a lot of times. So I mean, this is a perfect inroad, I think, talking about, you know, Casey's lyricism and everything to the first track on Relatives in Descent, which is called a Private Understanding. I remember the name that time.
Nice.
That was kind of tough.
You reached a private understanding.
I have, yeah.
Now public.
Yeah. But, so on this first track, which is called A Private Understanding, really, it's a showcase of Casey's ability to, the way I see it, to sort of interweave themes, you know, and images that are... might not seem to really mesh together at first, might seem a little sort of random. I mean, he's referencing Heraclitus, you know, at one point, you know, which is...
And who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for anybody that doesn't know who we're talking about here, Heraclitus was a pre-Socrates Greek philosopher, and his importance really for Casey's lyrics in this song is that one of Heraclitus's famous metaphors that he would use is the metaphor of flowing water as a, you know, blah, 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 blah. He would use flowing water as a metaphor for the ever-changing universe around us. That's what I'm trying to say. There we go. And, you know, there's these little anecdotes, you know, that Casey throws into the song about Elvis Presley, you know, driving a camper van in the desert outside Flagstaff, and he's having visions of... First, he has a vision of Joseph Stalin in the clouds, and then
That bums him out.
That bums him out, and then it changes to the face of Christ, if you will.
Yeah,
or
the Lord,
whatever. The Lord, yeah. And then
you can't figure out what that means.
Yeah, and then, of course, he just bumps, and then he drops it, you know... Drops that line, he passed away on the bathroom floor,
right.
So it's like kind of like, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a roller coaster of emotion there. Another thing too that I love is how he manages to work in a sort of cryptic, you know, but I think you'll find it if you're paying enough attention, a reference to the problem with the water in Flint, Michigan. Too, about the problem with lead, you know, lead levels being way too high.
Yeah, the Leaden River. So
in the river,
and,
yeah.
And it subverts that whole idea Heraclitus had of
mm-hmm.
You never step in the same river twice because it's always moving, and then you have
right.
leaden water, so that's not
mm-hmm.
going to be moving.
Right.
Disrupted things.
Right. And I think it works well too with a theme that's sort of hinted, you know, it's hinted at on this track, and then it's explored a lot more throughout the album, you know, which is of, you know, if you want to talk about a river that's not flowing, talk about the problems and the fallout of, you know, capitalism, unchecked
yeah.
capitalism. That's probably the number one
yeah.
theme on this record as far as looking at it from a sort of from a societal, you know, lens or through a societal lens. So
and a Detroit-based lens.
And a Detroit-based lens.
Although I didn't know when I listened originally they were from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not essential, although if you're hearing this, you will now know they're from Detroit. But
right.
It adds a kind of layering.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. And since I've been rambling about the lyrics, I mean, why don't you give us your take, like, on the, you know, the musicality of this track?
Oh, well,
what do you think?
I'll talk a second about the
lyrics
as well,
about the lyrics too,
just to get started in there.
Sure.
Since I'm, you know, theoretically the word guy.
Yeah.
But it's one interesting thing about this song. It definitely is a kind of clarion call of dread, and it's pre-Trump, but he's definitely giving a nod to what's going to happen with Trump. And I think the guy, I read an interview, I think the guy was a little bit prescient.
Mm-hmm.
I think he knew. In fact, in 2015, he was saying he was ready. He thought he could survive two Trump administrations.
Yeah.
And I don't know how tongue-in-cheek that was.
Right.
You know, he has an early line. He said, I don't want to hear vile trumpets anymore. And that sets up a lot of his attitude about what capitalism and corruption are doing.
Right.
And I'd say dread and menace are definite underpinnings of this record with some spikes of hope.
Right.
And then he also does something at the beginning I think is kind of an insight into his writing process. He mentions automatic writing, and automatic writing is initially was something mystics talked about, where a spirit would just come through you and you would write what they were saying. But also the surrealists and the Dadaists picked it up. And again, you write without calculation. And I believe he is in part indebted to that philosophy of writing. And and maybe that sometimes that and the beats, I think the outer edges of the beat poets and Naked Lunch as well, things like the more surreal aspects of the beats, you get those influences in his writing. So I think he's also kind of giving an entree, because he's very interested. He's an extremely literary guy, and so he's also interested in the process, and I think talking about the process as it goes along.
Right, right.
Yeah, and musically, I think this first song sets up a lot of the moves this band makes in an impressive way. It rolls in with just drums and a sort of martial drum beat, and then you start to get the menacing background guitar, and I think maybe even some synthesizer. But it's not explosive yet.
Right.
And then they have some really almost lovely breaks in this song where there's guitar strumming. And then you get what becomes a musical motif in here with they work to these crescendos. And you get this blast of guitar. And it's, again, heavily processed guitar that I think in some ways, you know, nods, as I said earlier, to industrial sounds. And then they fade out on the song with a lyrical refrain, she's just trying to reach you, that they also end the album with. And it's something like a lot of the things that go on here that's a little bit slippery. You can't literally nail it down, and I like that a lot. So it gets off to a pretty power-packed beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like the how... You know, you had mentioned how it starts with the drums, and then you get the acoustic guitars and the possibly some synthesizer in there, like you said, and that chord that's being strummed in that very first part when he starts talking about automatic writing, it's not discordant, but it's a very creepy sounding,
very like dissonance,
very very just like creepy sound, eerie sounding chord. So as far as setting the tone, it certainly does the job effectively. So, and like you said, a lot of, you know, building things up to a crescendo in this tune, which is great. I mean, I love when bands will sort of give you a cross section of what to expect from an album in the first track.
I agree.
I think that's a good I don't know what the word is. I'm looking for the expression modus operandi, I guess. I don't know yeah, what it is I'm looking for here, but
and it's all heading toward Elvis being on the bathroom floor. So
yeah, yeah, faces of Stalin.
I think Elvis would have dug this record, but
yeah probably. Who knows, right? There you go. But so yeah, I mean, from A Private Understanding, you know, this great opener, we move into the second track, which is called Here Is the Thing. And lyrically, you know, this one definitely, I feel almost like it's a somewhat of an extension of the first track, you know, because it continues that theme of capitalism and it's, you know, being detrimental, you know, to human life. But now it seems to me it's like through a more personal lens than it was maybe on the first track, and it's certainly more it's less sort of random, and it's, you know, there's not these strange anecdotes really, you know, going on in this track. It's a little bit more it's a little bit more on point, a little bit more on the nose, I think. And the fact that Casey, you know, mentioned in the NPR interview that we both had read, and we're going to reference quite a bit, I'm sure, during this podcast, you know, he mentions that the thing is supposed to be unfettered capitalism. So, so it's easy to sort of, you know, make that, you know, use that as the lens that you look through, and you can sort of see it's a person that sort of seems to be looking around his immediate environment, you know, whether it's Detroit or whether it's just any sort of, you know, urban.
Never trust the writer when he or she tells you what something means, though.
True.
And this,
especially this guy.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Because, you know, it's any good writing or songwriting or any sort of writing or art, you can't boil it down unless it's dumb.
Right.
You know, I don't think I want to slag Bon Jovi too much, but, you know, Bon Jovi's song, you can pretty much be sure what it is. But this song, you know, it's, the thing is also the dread of what's going on. And I like, you and I laughed about this before. One of the symbols he uses in here is a new parking garage. and he takes that as being, you know, indicative of the new economy of gentrification in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But it is the strangest symbol.
It really is.
I think it's pretty tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
The way he's using it. The guy is funny.
Right. His beef is with the parking garage.
The quandary. Now we're in the socio-political realm, but this guy is always in the socio-political realm, is what do you do with a failing city? And usually the solution is, or the solution he sees is, you kind of run the poor people out, it's rather than tend to them, and you try to attract, and that's, you know, again, it's a tricky balance. You try to attract a new industry, and a new industry in Detroit, like in a lot of places, is young white entrepreneurs for the most part, and he has real mixed feelings about, you know, losing the heart of Detroit.
Right.
And this song you brought up before, this is this is probably the most direct attack on the insidiousness of capitalism, and just how it creates a desire that can never be fulfilled. And then lyrically, I mean, and also the music's really straight ahead. And driving in the song, and he introduces a different lyrical tack that's sort of like, it's not jazz scat, but it's repetition. Here's the thing, or so. I guess it's more like good open mic poetry, shitty open mic poetry.
And musically, like you said, great bass line in the beginning there of Here's the Thing, and there's a sort of layered batch of synth like noise that
a little bit of tremolo
in there too that really amps up the dread factor in the beginning of this song, sort of fades away, you know, when he starts vocalizing, you know, when he starts doing the sort of scat poetry thing, you know, 2017 air horn age, age of horn blowers, you know, like. it's striking. It really is. I mean, if
and they start picking again, it's a guitar right. picking
mm-hmm.
instead of chords.
Yeah, yeah. Like sort of everything about this song musically is odd and like I said, has a sort of there's a dreadful sort of feel to a lot of it. So and more direct, more concise than the first track. So it's sort of, you know, trying to move you along now through the album. And did you have musically? Did you want to?
Well, that vortex at the beginning, it just reminds me if you ran a B3 Hammond through a robot's brain.
Which doesn't sound that odd or off-putting in the context of this album, really.
It's actually like Hammond it's B3, like, too, for all you
robots and
picky folk out there.
Right. Oh yeah, we're not tech experts here, right? So, but
that's been established.
Yeah. Oh goodness. So, I almost can't wait to get to that story. But in a way, I can wait. Yeah.
So. Age of Hornblower.
But
And then just one last.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
You and I talked about this as part of the story we will now not tell for a long time.
Yeah.
But it goes back again to Flint, but using Flint as a large thing says you have to choose necessity over health.
Yeah.
And it's about people drinking poisoned water because they have to drink some water. And
yeah.
That's a particularly powerful idea in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty tragic and just, yeah. And then, I mean, Casey goes from, I feel like now they go into this track called My Children, and I feel like now he pulls the camera in even closer. You know, he went from this sort of, you know, macrocosmic societal, you know, view to then in the second track, you know, could be more, you know, more focused a little bit more on his immediate surroundings or, you know, any sort of urban, like we said, urban decay, you know, mm-hmm. sort of that type of surrounding. And then we get to My Children where suddenly it's almost like he's turning the camera inward and there's these interesting images of and references to he says that his children enter the world through his temple, which anybody that knows their Greek mythology will know that the goddess Athena gave birth to her children through her temple. They, you know, emerged fully formed. And and Casey equates his children, you know, to his own thoughts, and he calls them motherless, and he calls them feral and unloved by their father. And also, like, one of the things that Casey does well too is using double meanings. Like in the beginning of this song, he keeps using the phrase "pass on,"
mm-hmm.
and it's a nice touch, you know, because you know, obviously he could be talking about passing something on as in an inheritance to, you know, to his children.
And is. Really.
And is. Right. But it can also, you know, mean passing on from one plane of existence
which
to another.
Which his children probably wanted this guy to right. do.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah. And, musically this one's pretty, it's pretty interesting too. There's a little, I think we had mentioned before that there's some more Joy Division creeping in, I think, on this one. In the beginning, especially with it has a very airy sort of sound in the beginning there, and very ominous, you know, ethereal sort of in a lot of ways, which really minimalist, which does, you know, definitely relates to that Joy Division, you know, school of thought, and I think that goes along well with that idea of, you know, his thoughts, you know, being his children, and you know, they're born out of his temple and everything. It's sort of it's the first well not the first but it's definitely one of the most effective uses on this record of Proto-Martyr's ability really to match lyrical content to music that
mm-hmm.
you know, they coalesce very well. So I definitely think that and you had mentioned about the sort of that Casey starts to sound like a preacher.
Yeah, he's
on this track,
sort
and
of the preacher of more from the Old Testament.
Yeah,
the yeah. children who are definitely carrying the sins of the father in a way.
Mm-hmm.
The music is, I agree with everything you've said about it. And mm-hmm. again, it's a pretty straightforward song in which they do a lot of interesting things with their instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And it picks up tempo mm-hmm. as it goes along. And then it almost becomes jaunty as
yeah.
the song becomes its darkest.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also the little lyrics become their darkest. Right. And I also like that about this band. I think there's always some sort of sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wouldn't say always. Yeah. But at times, I think these guys probably, you know, they're wags.
Mm-hmm.
To use a pretentious word, but this song again, it starts to really highlight the bass player.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's already you know, shown these great chops, but he, yeah. again, he really is driving this song in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And the sort of image that I hadn't really thought of before until you started to, you know, you were talking about how Casey starts to sound sort of like a Old Testament preacher. And it's odd because the song does take on that jaunty quality, and it's almost like a sort of really awkward like exorcism in a weird
it's
way.
True.
That's how the yeah.
Unloved,
yeah.
unloved.
Right. Yeah. And then and the lyrics just get more and more, you know, more and more ominous, you know, with Casey saying, you know, my children, they're right behind you. They're gonna beat you, you know, all this stuff. Like,
fear
my children.
That I reviled yes. and never loved.
Yeah.
You wonder where it comes from.
So, yeah, more and more happy stuff, you know. Yeah. So.
But it doesn't bludgeon you. That's the thing. I don't want to give that impression early on. I mean, it is. This song's catchy.
Right.
So it's not. This is not a song that's using industrial sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one that does have a catchy melody, not so much in the lyrics, but
yeah,
but in the music.
Yeah, the that sort of, you know, the melody that the guitars
mm-hmm.
use in this song is very especially because it's not a dense, you know, sound like they had, you know, like they use at other times on the record. It's very airy and light. So it does sort of. Yeah, it's definitely it's a little bit more. I used the word ethereal before. I don't really know like what.
Well, what it brings other... in something I heard a lot in the first record. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a Southwest U.S.
Mm-hmm.
guitar sound.
Yeah,
you know it's twangy. It's got it's
mm-hmm.
a little bit of reverb-y.
Yeah, great.
But it does. It's got that airy, atmospheric, airy
mm-hmm.
kind of sound, and
right.
And I like that being here.
Mm-hmm.
It fits, but it's, in some ways it shouldn't be there. It's,
right.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I said. It's sort of a welcome. It's a welcome change, you know, after the thickness and the just the weight of some of the sounds that have come on the these previous tracks.
And the guy in Casey saying, "Don't lean on me, man." I guess he's talking to the guitar.
I think it's pretty funny that I was reading in that NPR interview that he threw that line into that song because he was watching like a documentary about Bowie or something that day when he was writing the lyrics, because it was after Bowie's death, you know. And so he's like, I just sort of threw it in there, so. But that's cool, you know. That's something that, like, if you're paying attention, you'll notice that.
Automatic writing.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. So here, the record, lyrically, it takes sort of an interesting left turn, I think, because we've been sort of, I don't want to say bludgeoned to death with, you know, the sort of anti-capitalism stance, you know, that Casey's taking. But all of a sudden here, the narrative shifts. All of a sudden now, there's a song that's called Katrina, and it's, Casey wrote the lyrics to this song after reading an Irish novel, which was called Cré na Chéile, I believe. That's how it is. I'm Irish, but I don't speak Gaelic or Irish, so please don't leave me angry comments, especially not in Irish, because I won't know what you're saying. But But it was this novel written by a guy named Martin O'Cadane, I'll say. And it basically, you know, it's about this mother who is, you know, in the coffin. You know, this is taking place after she's died. And she's just really bitter and sort of angry at her son for burying her in such a fashion that, you know, she believes he was just trying to sort of cut corners and save money for his quote unquote plain wife. I think that's how she puts it. Yeah, it definitely, like I said, it's like an odd left turn for me. It's like a curveball. I find it to be a little bit more darkly humorous,
yeah,
you know, than what has come before. I think Casey was being pretty serious, you know, for the most part on the first couple of tracks. And then here, I think he is trying to inject a little bit of humor. So,
did you get that when you listened to it before you knew the lyrics?
About the novel?
About the subject matter in the song.
The thing that made me realize, like, all of a sudden, you know, there's been a shift, like, in perspective or in location, even if you will, is there's that line where, you know, the mother says, "I'll be spitting on the living until I get my cross of Connemara stone." And I wouldn't have known what Connemara meant if I hadn't, you know, after I went to Ireland, you know, with my wife, and we spent some time in the southwest part of Ireland, and we went to the area that's Connemara. So very picturesque sort of seaside, you know, area. And so that's why I all of a sudden I went, wait a minute. So now we're not in, you know, we're not in Detroit, and we're not in, you know, we're not in this sort of desolate waste, you know, capitalist wasteland. Yeah, now we're underground in the southern Ireland. So it's kind of a weird sort of shift. But I think that you know, it's a humorous image, and this spiteful ghost looking you know down, or as you had mentioned before, more like looking up, since she's in the coffin, right? Looking up at the you know, her living, you know, descendants with disappointment and spite, you know. I said it seems very, like, Irish in a way to me. It's a very, like...
Now you've offended all the Irish.
I probably have, yeah, but...
I like this song. Everything starts at once from the first beat. Because
yeah.
A lot, I think probably all three of the songs before this come in and start to layer,
mm-hmm.
but this just explodes,
right.
And that's what caught me. I thought it was an angry, bitter song that was serious in tone,
mm-hmm.
until I read the lyrics. Right. Like, oh, but it's still, I mean, depending on what kind of relationship you have with your mother,
right,
or your son, if you are a mother,
mm-hmm.
this song could be very serious to you,
right?
And it does, right. One connective tissue it mm-hmm. has is it's with the song before it is, it's just not good parental progeny.
True.
Yeah. Relationship. Don't use this as a model, everybody. I know Ryan is a good father, so he's not.
I try my best.
I hope he's not taking these songs as inspiration.
No, certainly not. No. My children did not spring from my temple, but.
No.
Sometimes I find myself, you know, rubbing my temples, you know.
Should we move on to the next happy song?
Oh God, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, so from the slight peak, like in, the, you know, we're talking about peaks and valleys here. I guess the song about the vengeful mother spirit yelling at her son from the coffin is kind of a high on the peaks.
Really.
Peaks and valleys, and then we move into this track that's called The Chuckler. And The Chuckler, to me, lyrically, it is very depressing in a lot of ways, but to me, like, the essence of it is that it's about small victories and small pleasures, you know, in the face of just overwhelming dread and uncertainty and toil and routine. And
environmental disaster.
Environmental disaster. Yeah, and musically, this track, The Chuckler, it never really opens up. The beat never really changes. I mean, the song goes through the music goes through a couple little variations, but it's very straightforward, and the feel of that, you know, that beat that never really quite opens up is sort of claustrophobic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it, to me, that fits so well with the, you know, with the theme of the lyrics. And I know you enjoyed a couple of the little, you know, little slice of life anecdotes that are in here, especially I think the one with the telemarketer. I think you really enjoyed that.
Yeah, he's just there. So particular part. This is reading again. This is based on an actual conversation he had with a telemarketer, I think, from Pakistan or India.
Mm.
And he engages the guy, but the guy finally, bizarrely enough, in the song, I don't know if it happened in real life, tells him that his name is Laszlo. And the narrator says, "You say your name is Laszlo. I don't believe that's true, because I know a Laszlo, and he's not half as smart as you." So you also got this bizarro world logic, and the combination of strange name. Sounds like he's out of a 70s science fiction movie, you know, or Flash Gordon from a TV show.
Oh, my goodness.
But yeah, they he's talking about the music. It starts with it's just ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. I mean, there's no variation in drums. It sounds... I can't tell if it's a processed snare, a processed kick drum, or sometimes it even sounds like maybe it's clicking sticks and it's processed. But it's so there's that industrial aspect moving in again, and you got that again. It's a lot of high picking on the electric guitar. Then and they move up again. This is a little bit of their formula. They hit with really aggressive industrial guitar. In the middle of the song, and but you know, again, the way they do it, it's a payoff. And the Casey again is mostly talking these lyrics, but he's got a really provocative, deep, sort of flat at times flat voice. But it's you know, you can see him smoking a cigarette on stage.
Right. Yeah. It just. I mean, it works. He knows how to, you know, because in the first verse, you know, he's talking about the. You know, the fact that, you know, these people working at, you know, basically it sounds like it's at a, some sort of small business, or, you know, could be at a chain or something, but they're the high point of their day is that they are not allowing this really shitty customer to get what they want. and then, you know, and then talking about the interaction with, quote unquote, Laszlo, you know, the telemarketer, he has this ability with his voice to sort of convey, to make these situations seem, you know, there's humor in there. It's humorous, but it's also sort of bleak at the same time. Yeah. You know, it's a very sort of like black, you know, humor, very sort of just sarcastic, to a degree. And, I just think, you know, he's found his niche, you know, in that sense, you know, that he that he could take, he's going to take these very ordinary or pedestrian situations, but he's going to assign them this, you know, this importance. And then when you get, like you said, when you get to that chorus, and the really heavy guitars come in, and then the lyrics perfectly match it too there, where he's talking about the clouds of, you know, clouds of poison in the sky and poison in the soil. And, you know, you just have that reminder of the things that are literally hanging above your head, you know, these dark clouds that are hanging above your head. And, you know, that, it's never far away, you know, lyrically, as far as that theme of the effects of capitalism. So, and it certainly doesn't go away in the next track.
Well, but you know,
before we go to that,
I just have to say the lines I quoted and that Ryan referred to with Laszlo. Right. Those are my favorite lyrics in the song, and I could hear those the first listen. And I did. We were talking about this is not particularly a sing-along record, but I did find myself singing that, right? It's, or whatever you call what this guy's doing. Because they're just really hilarious. And then the lyrics Ryan talked, just the chorus, because I think it's worth noting how uplifting it is.
Yeah.
Even though this is literally a laugh instead of cry song. It's called The Chuckler, and
right.
He's going to laugh until the breath leaves his lungs.
Lungs,
but that's the way he's going to get through. Mm-hmm. And, but it starts with the chorus starts with war and rumors of war.
Right.
And then it goes to environmental disaster.
Yeah.
So.
It kind of it covers a lot of ground in three or four lines, you know, and just that, and you know, that last line of, I wish there was a better end to this joke, you know, like it's just, it wraps up that, you know, that sort of nihilistic, but also, you know, blackly humorous, package, you know, sort of ties it all together in it with a sort of neat little bow. So,
that's exactly what I thought. Yeah. It was a neat little bow.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, talk about, just being able to like instill that much, you know, lyrically into and musically into a song that doesn't really change very much, like we said. I mean, it's very straightforward. It's very, you know,
we're listening to these tracks a little bit in between talking about songs. Mm-hmm. And I said, it goes back to something I said earlier. I mean, the record actually seems more minimalist every time
mm-hmm.
I listen to it.
Yeah.
Just so it's, again, it does unfold or kind of morph.
Yeah. All right, so now we get to what Tim has indicated is his favorite track.
I think on
at least
this
at
record,
this
yeah.
at this point,
it's
yeah.
grown on me.
Yeah, this track that's called Windsor Hum, which is easily the eeriest track on this thing. And apparently, this Windsor Hum, it's an actual phenomenon. I learned when I was reading the interview with Casey. It's this hum that supposedly emanates from across the river from Detroit, right? In Windsor, Canada, and it has to do with this place that's called Zug Island, which just Zug Island sounds like it sounds like the lair of like a really bad, like, I don't know, like a villain in an 80s. Cartoon, like Thundercats or something. Like, that's what it sounds like to me.
Tourist stop in hell.
Yeah, I think Casey actually said that it looks and smells as hellish as that name would imply or something like that. So, yeah. But yeah, and I mean, here's another, as far as the lyrics go, here's another you know, very minimal
mm-hmm.
minimal song. I mean, literally you have Casey repeating this, you know, the sound
yes.
over and over. You know, coming from across the river, letting you know that everything's fine, like, and it, the overall effect, you know, of the lyrics and the music, you know, put together in the song is to, you know, give you the sense that nothing is fine, and you're just being, you know, you're being soothed back to sleep, if you will, mm-hmm. I guess, or the wool is just sort of being pulled over your eyes, you know, and so I think it very much goes back into the themes explored, you know, earlier on the record, maybe in a little bit, I don't know. So it's in certain ways, it seems a little bit more abstract to me than the earlier tracks, but then it gets to, you know, there's lines in the song that are very on the nose,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the, that chant of, you know, want, 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 what you give in. So definitely, you know, definitely gets back into that sort of, attack on capitalism. So,
yeah, and it kind of, musically, it is back in a kind of formula they use at times. It starts with drums, and then that high chiming guitar comes in. Like,
mm-hmm.
Sounds a little bit like The Edge in U2, but
mm-hmm.
more interesting.
Yeah. There's not seven effects pedals.
That's right.
At once,
right? And then it comes in again with a killer bass line.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very a deep bottom, like a jazz, like a Fender jazz.
A big bottom.
Really big bottom. Yeah, can't leave that behind. And it's very loose stringed. And then he comes in, like Ryan said, with just, you know, saying the sound several times. And then at a certain point in the song, again, you get that heavily processed guitar attack that sounds a lot, sounds industrial to me. And, and they use it really effectively. And then he works up to the chorus. Ryan also talked about it. It's the most, I think, rageful he is on this record.
Yeah.
And he's definitely got the voice for that. And I like, it's a really provocative and interesting and creepy song. The guitar at the beginning sounds to me, I mean, it evokes The Outer Limits. Which I think is probably pretty apt.
Yeah, I think so.
We dig it.
We dig it, yeah, definitely. So I would say so. And
it said too, just before we go, only certain people can hear that hum. It says Casey can't. That's probably because Casey's frequencies have been burned out by being in bands as well. But it's interesting too that it's a frequency that only comes through to certain people.
Yeah.
I pity those people.
Right. Yeah, because you said you didn't you go through there? You went to Windsor, definitely.
Yeah,
sure,
we crossed when I was interviewing for this job at the Modern Language Association conference in 94. We went through Detroit, and when we were stopped at the border in Canada, they asked me and the two nerdy and very obnoxious PhDs who were in the car with me if we had any literature, and you know, we were all perplexed. We realized they were asking you pornographic. Of course, we didn't have any of that, much to our disappointment.
That's pretty funny. And just one more thing about this song that I honestly hadn't even noticed. I mean, I've listened to this record upwards of 30 times probably by now, 30 something times, and it was the first time I really noticed how the point when the very just chaotic sounding guitar noise comes in, that industrial bit, you know, Casey, it's when he's repeating that line that everything's fine, and the way he vocalizes there when he says everything's fine, and it's sort of it's weird because it sort of fades into the industrial noise, like in a very sort of just creepy, like unsettling, you know, kind of hair on the back of your neck goes up kind of way. And that's something that I hadn't, like I said, I hadn't noticed, you know, however many times I've listened to this thing, that I didn't really, it sort of went over my head. So it just goes to show you that you can listen to this thing that many times and there's just so many layers, and so, you know, you'll come back to it and you'll find something new every time. So it's pretty cool in that way. So
it's ironic, but it does. That's what we say, ironic.
All right. So the record moves into, well, I mean, my sort of favorite track as far as this record goes, Shifts. It moves around a lot. Depends on, you know, the day. And but Don't Go to Anacita has been, you know, one of my favorites on this record since the first time I listened to it. Much like that track Katrina, you know, this one is definitely more straightforward and concise, and not a lot of, you know, variety or tempo changes or you know, time signature changes or anything like that. And lyrically, it's pretty cool. I like, you know, Casey he created this fictional town called Anacita, actually in a previous Proto Martyr song that was called Born to Be Wine, which apparently you know, he wrote about a retired rock star, you know, who lives in this town that's you know, you're sort of what you see more and more, these sort of gated community type towns, which in a lot of ways just have this sort of, you know, artificial, like just this facade, you know, like, you know, draped over all the dark, you know.
None of that in Connecticut.
Connecticut. Never. So, but it's a bit tough to sort of nail down exactly, for me, exactly how, like, Casey, you know, feels about the people of Anacita, you know, as he's describing them in this song. You know, he refers to them as liberal-minded. But,
well, I think he refers to a portion of them.
Or a portion, yeah.
Because they, you know, I mean, they do seem like fundamentalist Christians in some way. Mm-hmm. Or at least conventional Republicans, right, if not as far out as I just said, because they're
right.
What's the line about they love the unborn more?
He's basically saying like they love the abstract sort of unborn, but once you're out, you're on your own. Like that's
right,
the
right. And
that's
then I think the line about the liberals, it says, I think it's more the, I don't have the line written there, but it's more they've been co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
Because they like their nice stuff and they're willing to go along with this racist place where you bring the migrants in to plant the trees and,
mm-hmm.
and you kick their butts out when the sun goes down.
Yeah. I love the fact that he throws in, I wasn't sure the first couple of times what he was saying, but there's one line where he says that you can keep them happy with, I don't remember what the first thing he says, but then he says kombucha, is like, you know, it's like a ginger sort of drink or something, but it's one of those things that like every like health nut or like, you know, people that are just like obsessed with, you know, sucking down like whatever, you know, Dr. Oz is like telling you to drink. Like it's one of those things like that you just see. And I mean, I've like smelled the stuff before and I think it smells disgusting. Like it's just one.
Well, it's because it's healthy.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, just the overall, you know, it's little details like that sort of, you know, add them all up and you get this idea of, like you said, of like co-opted, co-opted fundamentalist Christians, you know, living behind their gates and their fences, you know, and
with their goon squads. It mentions their goon squads in there.
Mm-hmm. Which is another thing that you can tell that Casey, when he's writing a lot of these lyrics, you know, that he's just, you know, he's looking at these, you know, different things that he's you know, either seeing on the news or he's just reading about in the paper. Like I forget where it was, but I was reading a story about how this one community like wanted to get like basically their own police force that was like through their church. Like they wanted to get this approved.
Right.
I forgot exactly where it was,
after the shooting at the church in Texas.
Yeah. And it's just, it's
church militia.
A church militia, yeah. Like that doesn't, you know, doesn't sound like a bad idea at all, right? You know, but it definitely, I get the sense that, he's putting all of these things into his sort of into his bank of ideas and everything, and you know, he always finds a way to work that kind of stuff in, which is pretty cool. Even if a lot of the stuff is you know, not necessarily vague, but a lot of it is hard to read, you know, hard to sort of get all the references unless you do a little bit of work, you know, a little bit of research. So, but yeah, for a song that musically is straightforward and not all that complex, I mean, still accomplishes a lot.
Yeah, I mean, so it's I like the song a lot because it is a conventional rock song. It mm-hmm. starts with you know, a 4/4 beat with mm-hmm. a really cool backbeat, and then it is verse, chorus.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a guitar solo, but you can, one can easily drop in there. And this could be a relationship song.
Yeah,
lyrically, I mean, it fits that. But and it is a relationship song between the doomed and the undoomed, I guess, or anything.
Yeah. Right.
Or the all doomed. but yeah, I agree. It's really approachable. It's straight ahead, but it's a song that could be on the radio if radio didn't suck for the most part. So.
Yeah. Also, another one of the handful of times I feel like on the record, like we were talking about with Windsor Hum, how it has a very a melody that's easy to latch onto.
Mm-hmm.
Like this one has that too, that chorus, very easy to get that stuck in your head and to sing along with that.
Yeah, that's
so
a great chorus.
Yeah. And it's just delivered in a way that like only Casey can, you know, like it doesn't
sound like a melody that's as dark that should be carrying that darkness,
right?
We're finding a theme here too, the way the darkness of his lyrics sometimes mm-hmm. grinds up against these melodies that are kind of pleasing and jaunty, even though I said early on in this there are no melodies. But that's part of Heraclitus. There, you know, these opposites exist at once.
That's true.
So really, I was channeling Heraclitus.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Get your pen. Get ready for your automatic rating there. Right?
Yes.
So.
Don't poke myself in the eye.
Yeah. Please don't. Please. All right, so from Don't Go to Aniceta now, the record moves into this track called Up the Tower, which is, I mean, it's not necessarily, it's still pretty straightforward, I'd say. Like, it doesn't get any more really complex than Don't Go to Aniceta does. But if Don't Go to Aniceta is a song that could get played on the radio, Up the Tower is probably as far as you could get.
Different kind of radio.
Different kind of radio, yeah. But yeah, another very, very, very interesting lyrical yarn spun by Casey, you know, about you know, how he shares a cigarette with this kind of, you know, possibly vagrant guy outside of a bar or a club or whatever, and he says that the cigarette opens the guy's head up, and then he proceeds to tell Casey this story, which is a is about a basically a money-hungry troll that lives in a golden tower, and about, you know, the sort of common people, the common folk rising up to...
First part doesn't sound familiar at all.
Yeah, no, not at all. Slightly on the nose, right? But, you know, the common, it's about the common people basically ascending the tower and chucking out the troll. So... That's the gist of the lyrics, you know, and I think that this is definitely one of like the most, it's one of the most striking songs as far as like you said, in Windsor Hum, you know, that's where Casey probably shows the most rage, you know, the most anger. This, I feel like it comes pretty close, I think. You know, at the point when the common people have reached sort of the door, you know, in the tower where they're gonna confront this troll, you know, and you know, Casey says, you know, knock on the door, and then it goes into this refrain of knock it down, you know, where he's yelling knock it down over and over and over again. It's cathartic, and the, you know, the music becomes pretty chaotic too, you know, with the drums, they become way more thunderous than anything you've really heard on this record before. So it definitely, yeah, it's another song, like I've mentioned, that that matches the music with the lyrics really well. And one of the things that I really like, that I think is kind of funny about this song, is how when the people they get inside the chamber, they knock the door down, if you will, and they get inside the chamber with this troll, with this, you know, money hungry troll, and you know, before they decide to throw him out the window, they sort of get distracted by this view that they get out, you know, the window of the tower, and the, you know, Casey sings, you know, oh, what a lovely view, you know,
crooning
a little bit, and it's, I think it's sort of indicative of, you know, this idea that I think, you know, it's not hard to make the sort of connection to the idea of people that are the victims of capitalism, sort of becoming, you know, being so used to their surroundings, you know, you know, the desolation and everything, that when they're presented with a different perspective, it's almost, it's like almost bewitching, you know, in a way. So it takes them a minute to realize that, oh wait, we're supposed to murder this. So the murder of the troll, supposed to get rid of this troll, you know?
The proletariat, timeshare, and they'll keep it down.
Yep. So it's another one of my favorites on the record, and it's actually the first this track and the two tracks that follow it are actually part of like a supposedly a trilogy, I guess, that, although I in that NPR interview, Casey said that like he didn't even realize they were a trilogy. He's like, somebody told me that, basically. But so take that as you will, take what you want from that. But I definitely see the connection between this one and the next two, but we'll talk about that when we get to the next one. So we'll What would you like to add?
Well, this is the one.
I rambled a little, sorry.
No, this is one where if I were in the audience in a live show, I'd be like everybody else, shaking my fist. And,
yeah.
Throw them out. It's a good release. But yeah, it's again got the formula of starting more minimalist or quieter and then exploding. And it's got we think it comes in with a bass. It's one note, maybe two notes, but it's bum, 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 bum. Mm-hmm. And it's heavily processed.
Mm-hmm.
And then Casey starts talking about having a cigarette bummed off him. And, again, the music. It doesn't even layer that much in this song. I mean, it works up, and then it just blows up. And it goes back. And the little crooning part in there is it's really smart.
Yeah.
And interesting. But the thing about the song, I don't think either Ryan or I realized first that, there's this frame of giving the guy the cigarette, and then the guy tells this story, because it sounds like it's a song about revolution, but it's actually a song about a guy who just bummed a smoke telling a story of a revolution. That's not really happening. Which again is a pretty literary move if you look at it.
Yeah.
But it's also Casey undercutting, any kind of serious notion that capitalism is going to be overthrown or troll tossed out of Trump Tower, just to be obvious about it.
Funny because you mentioned about the kind of effect that song could have performed live. On an audience, and that's the kind of song that you'd almost be worried about just how amped up people might get playing a song like that in a place. You'd be worried about people like possibly destroying things. So it's kind of definitely a song that I think anyone who shares the same sort of view of, capitalism and just the state of, especially like I'd imagine anyone who's a fan of this band who's from Detroit, I would say probably would definitely be able to get behind the sort of message,
could incite a mosh.
Could incite a mosh pit, yes, which is not the first thing you think of.
No.
Really, when you think of Proto Martyr, it's kind of funny. But so from the chaos of Up the Tower, then the track moves into, this sort of part two, if you will, of this trilogy. This track is called Night Blooming Sirius. And Casey, he presents this image of this flower that only blooms in the dark. And for me, I find it to be a pretty powerful analogy for a spark of creativity, that always will bloom in times of adversity, in times of chaos, in times of crisis. It's sort of a cause and effect thing. I mean, that type of pressure from any sort of from capitalism, from any sort of government pressure or anything like that, like, is always going to produce. It's always going to produce the spark of creativity. I mean, obviously, punk itself, you really need to sort of look no further, than punk itself when it comes to a scene, growing out of, like a counterculture
movement,
urban decay and everything. Yeah, so
societal collapse in England.
Yep. Yeah.
It's the most derivative of 80s music, I think, they still make it their own, but it reminded me, although I wasn't a big synth fan of the beginning, it maybe could be something from an Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark record, and then his vocals remind me of very early Psychedelic Furs, when Burton's voice was a lot rougher and raspier, and the whole band was a lot rougher than they became pretty in pink. But But yeah, it's and he said, is that, I thought the reading about it, the inspiration for this was when that artist collective, the ghost ship in California burned, and all those young people were killed, and it just reminded him of the kind of scenes and clubs he grew up in, which had the DIY spirit. And, and so, like Ryan said, you know, the night blooming flower is creativity emerging from these dark places.
Yeah, and then he there was that story too about how then he found later that I forget the name now, the poet the guy that was the poet laureate.
Oh yeah, Robert Hayden.
Robert Hayden, right.
The only African American poet laureate who was from Detroit and from a neighborhood called Sirius and wrote the poem called Night Blooming Sirius.
Right.
Yeah, that was
Yeah, that's a pretty amazing connection. So sure is. I'm sure that was a big moment for Casey right there, so realizing that connection. So it's the kind of connection that would make you probably feel like I'm doing something right, you know?
Yeah. Robert Hayden, just as an aside, wrote one of my favorite poems. It's about a relationship to a son and a father, a very young son and a father. It's called Those Winter Sundays. And it's just beautiful. So check it out. You can Google it online if you're into father-son relationships and love. Great alliteration. Onomatopoeia.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and then sort of things kick back into gear with
maybe my favorite chorus.
Yeah, another provocative.
It's a rabble rouser.
Another provocative track. Yep. Male plague. This is, and yeah, just I mean, I'm sure I could say a lot about the lyrics, but to me, it's just this is, you know, it's about the idea and the you know, in Casey's mind, that hopefully the implementation, you know, of just dismantling old systems, you know,
yeah,
specifically
patriarchy.
Yeah, that, you know, I think he believes, you know, is something that will happen in time, but he's sort of resigned to the fact that it's not happening, you know, as quickly as he would like. And there's certainly it's definitely a battle that, you know, no one's gonna go quietly, and basically, and that's certainly something that we I'd say we're, you know, we can see everywhere right now. So that's for sure.
And he's not completely sure it won't still win out, like you said, because it's something that it could kill you. Again, the line, just every boy wants to be a cop. Again, it's a very direct line for him. But it just sort of sums up the whole macho business. But the ironic part of this song is the chorus is actually the way he yells it, and the way it was presented is pretty macho.
Yeah.
And again, I'm sure I'm sure he's aware of it. And you know, probably also there's tongue in cheek stuff going on there, because they're four dudes in a band that's pretty heavy and aggressive. And they're talking about dismantling the patriarchy.
We have more. Let's talk about a band that has, you know, more than one side for sure. And people trying to sort of reconcile that. Not to get into current events too much, you know, but
you don't like Trump.
Yeah, no, he doesn't. And I think you know what we just saw happen, you know, with the election in Alabama. I mean, you know, yes, Doug Jones won, Democrat won, which is, you know, which is amazing in and of itself.
Yeah, it is.
But I mean, just the fact that, you know, it's not like he buried more. I mean, there certainly wasn't a landslide.
No.
So you know, it's great that he won, but I mean, just the fact that many people were still supportive of Roy Moore, despite, you know, all the, you know, all just the awful, you know, shit that man is capable of, apparently. You know, it's just goes to show, yeah.
These are my people.
That
Louisiana that lived in Bama 7 years.
Yeah.
You ain't going to tell them what to do.
Right. Yeah. Party over people, unfortunately, right? All right, so.
Now for something completely different.
Yeah. No shit. Yeah. Now we move into this track called Corpses and Regalia, which, I mean, I don't know if we've adequately pinned it down, but we said that it was surrealist disco.
Yes.
Is that what you said? Yeah. Talk about just a very odd song. And, I know that, reading the interview with Casey, like lyrically, this song wasn't, you know, didn't have so much of a theme that ran through it, a solid theme, you know, as with a lot of the other songs. It was a little bit more about just sort of these different images that he had. But I really like how he does some more work with double meanings, you know, in this track. Like he's talking about drinking Balthazars and drinking Nebuchadnezzars, and here, you know, they're different size quantities of wine, basically, but they're also the names of, you know, Babylonian kings. You know, so it in a way, you know, it sort of fits it. It sort of fits in with a lot of the themes on the record, just of of just massive corruption and you know, stuff of that nature. And I mean, just musically, it's so weird. Like I remember thinking as soon as I heard some of the jangly guitar, you know, the little stabs of guitar that were in there, I immediately made me think of Johnny Marr, you know, from Smiths.
Yeah.
And that bass line, you know,
all that gets left behind.
Yeah. When it picks up, you know, it really is, it's like out of left field. Like you're just like, wow, you know, and the fact that Proto Martyr can still surprise you this far into the record.
Yeah.
Is pretty impressive. As far as I'm concerned. So, but, a very strange track. Yeah. So.
It's a really good disco.
It is.
it would get people.
Yeah, I'm saying strange, like I don't want people to think that I'm saying it's a bad strange. Like, right. No, this is a very good strange.
Yeah.
So.
But it's it'd be a hard turn going from Male Plague or Throw 'Em Out to this song. Or,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But I read in one review to just today, they were comparing this a little bit to Gang of Four. But it's not nearly as angular or as strange as Gang of Four, at least earlier Gang of Four.
Yeah.
Although I can, you know, no, I'm not going to get on that. But, yeah, this is much more straight ahead. But, again, you got this disco song with these surrealist lyrics and also the, you know, political, slightly political edge, again, of... Mm-hmm. Contempt for people with a lot of money. It's a I think we talked about last time, it's sort of Club Med from hell. But everybody's dancing,
right?
So, you know, how bad can it be?
Well, yeah, I mean, that line, you know, of you know, the people walking on the sand, like, no, it's not sand, it's little bones. I think he says. And that watch where you go, that, you know, that
right.
That repeated line is just, yeah, it is very it's very odd, you know, to sort of match that with the you know, with the music. And I think I said last time that I was getting the feeling that Casey's like anger that comes out in that those words, yelling watch where you go and all that, like it's almost like it was a result of, you know, him hearing the music and saying, like, all right, how much further in the other direction can I go? Because this is starting to sound.
The band.
Yeah, like, watch, yeah. What, yeah, watch where you're going with this sound. Like, you know, so it's definitely, yeah, it's interesting in that sense. And that's why, like I said, that's one of the reasons that I love this band, is because they'll do stuff like this that, just completely will throw you for a loop at first, and but
you alluded again to our as of yet untold tale.
Yes.
Of the,
God.
The previous recording.
The precast. Yeah. Oh, God.
We'll just get it out of the way. We did this last week. Yeah. Ryan erased it somehow.
Yeah. Yep.
It's better this time.
And yeah, I think
even
so.
Even though this is incredibly verbose, it was even more incredibly verbose last time.
Right, yeah. And we've sort of established that it could be Tim's fault.
Yes.
We're not sure.
Yeah.
Tim has some sort of, I don't know what the word is. You're
techno-obliteration.
You're like one of the X-Men
power,
or something.
Yeah,
like you.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I have the safeguards on this time, maybe, to make sure that I don't erase it. If I erase it, I think we'll just never, ever record anything ever again.
Yeah.
That's probably what's going to happen.
We'll sing our own versions of the song.
Exactly. Couldn't be any stranger than, you know, the material itself, I guess, right? Well, maybe it could. I don't know.
Decent folk don't live like that.
Yeah, that's true. But finally, we get to the last track on the album. This track is called Half Sister. And this is a track that's definitely grown on me. I was just talking to Tim about this. First few times I listened to the record, I sort of felt like it wasn't the best way that they could have closed the record. I felt like it was a little bit more of not necessarily like putting a period on the album. Like it was almost like more of like, more of like an ellipses, if you will. But actually, the more I've listened to the record, the more I think that that's appropriate. Because it is a record that's largely about uncertainty, and, you know, questions that don't have, you know, questions that aren't easily answered, problems that aren't easily solved. So I think it does, I think it is a fitting ending. I think I had to warm up a little bit to it, but it's hard not to warm up to the lyrics, because Casey is just, you know, he's using these really, sort of bizarre, anecdotes in the story. He's talking about, you know, basically like messengers who are wannabe prophets, you know, in ancient Palestine, you know, and the king basically saying like, you know, you're one of a backlog of prophets that I have, like, there's nothing special about you, you know, like you're, I have an entire Rolodex of you basically. And he also tells a story about a ghost that keeps appearing in a back garden in Darlington, and I think he says in 1963, and it turns out that the ghost is the not the guy who's seeing the ghost, right? It's not his half sister.
Ghost is just telling him his half sister.
Right, that's what it is. Right,
doesn't like you.
Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, very bizarre. And
the ghost body fades away as the morning grows, but the voice keeps telling him.
Right. So yeah, lingering sort of voice of disapproval, if
that's
you will,
right.
Which sort of in a way,
yes,
strangely goes back.
The lingering voice of disapproval.
Right, it goes back to Katrina.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yeah,
and
it's got the familial stuff.
Yeah.
Right, my
yeah. So, and then there's the story about the horse,
oh, yeah.
Which is just completely absurd and hilarious
and disturbing.
And disturbing all at the same time. Yeah. The horse in northern Michigan gets struck by lightning, starts to speak a foreign language, and just before the humans decide to shoot it, they realize that the horse is saying humans are no good. That's what it's saying over and over. Humans are no good. It's like, it's funny because there's the automatic writing and this is like automatic horse speak. I don't know. It's weird.
I wonder where you were going with that. Automatic horse speak. That's another band name.
Yeah. Get right on that. And, and then, to make the story even stranger, then the humans decide to stuff the horse, put him on display for kids to remember to always do their best and do their best always. So
makes
you're
perfect sense.
Yeah, you're sort of left with this, you know, this package of like really bizarre images in this track.
And he keeps repeating always. Kind of rubs. Do your best always.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, it's almost as if, it's almost as if you can imagine the horse still speaking, you know, but it did, but in this instance, yes, it's just repeating, do your best always. I know, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I know you're gonna have to go to bed after I leave, but sorry. But I think lyrically, I always was at least interested in the song. Musically, I think that's where I needed to warm up to the song. I thought that the sort of plotting sort of nature of the song, you know, was kind of boring at first. I wasn't really into it, but the more I listened to it and the more I was able to pick apart the different things that were going on in the song, in the music of the song, that's when it became much more interesting to me. Like you were saying, they're able to just get some great guitar, guitar sounds on this tune. And also too, something that I had noticed but I hadn't really thought about too much was, you know, how near, closer to the end of the song, the bass is really carrying the melody.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another, element of the sound that's reminiscent of Joy Division, you know, of Peter Hook, I think. Yeah, Peter Hook was the bassist in Joy Division. Yeah, he, you know, of his style of playing, because he had that very upfront, you know, sort of bass playing, whereas I think it was Bernard Sumner was the guitarist. He, you know, he tended to a lot of the time the guitar work, you know, in Joy Division was always like more kind of splashes of guitar more than it was.
Too.
Right. Yeah. So it's definitely interesting. Yeah. That that you know they sort of that they came back to that, and because you know Joy Division is obviously such a huge, it's like a monolithic sort of, you know, influence when it comes to anybody who falls under the, you know, the post-punk sort of tent, if you will. So yeah, like definitely something didn't grab me right away, this track. But Tim, it seems like you always, since first listen, you were pretty into it.
Yeah, I like this song, and the guitar at the beginning, more than Joy Division to me, is Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yeah,
it's that really distorted and basically playing one chord, and while, as you said, you know, the bass carries a melody, and I was going to say droning, that was my pause, but it's not, it's not, it's drone-esque,
and, it's approaching drone.
That's right. And again, he's lead singer is talking his way through a lot of this, and earlier I said Laszlo was my favorite lyrics, but I do think the lyrics about the horse rival Laszlo. They're sheer strangeness, and and it's the only rhyme in on the whole record, and it's a it's a second grade rhyme. It's understood and no good, and so I also like that pops up, and it's because there's no typical pop song or traditional rock and roll rhyming that sticks out, and it's just dumb.
See, I like that I like that Casey, because I mean, obviously, I'm sure he's not doing that by accident, you know.
No.
And that he's, you know, he's willing to do that. There's a certain amount of, you know, like you said, tongue in cheek, you know, humor there, like maybe some self deprecating humor there, you know, he's willing to laugh at himself, you know, and I can definitely appreciate that, because I think that you know, that sort of I guess Morrissey-esque self-deprecation,
yeah,
you know,
healthy dose of misanthropy or misanthropy, however you want to pronounce it, thrown in. So I think it does in some way sum up his feelings about a large part of the human race.
Yeah.
Finally understood. Humans are no good.
Okay. Yeah. Straight from the horse's mouth. Ooh.
Right. Oh, yes. Mr. Ed.
Yeah, so that's that's how we end this album. So,
and I just love this line in the song, of course, called Half Sister, and it says, "Truth is the half sister who will not forgive." That is a very complicated metaphor. Mm-hmm. I still have it quite. I don't think I can unpack it.
Right.
So I think it gets back though to those themes you were bringing up earlier too about just the unknowability of things.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also brought up the half sister, and her already is this distant figure
mm-hmm.
who doesn't approve and doesn't forgive. But then you bring them together. Truth is the half sister who will not forgive. It just doesn't quite make sense
mm-hmm.
to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if it does to you, but again it's provocative and pretty dark
mm-hmm.
and pessimistic, but the song ends with that refrain that's at the end of the first song. She's just trying to reach you, and you don't know exactly who she is. Maybe it's mm-hmm. a half sister, but truth is also the half sister, but the half sister
right.
won't forgive. But going out, it's haunting, and it's also encouraging because somebody's trying to make a connection.
Right, right, yeah. The only idea I sort of have as far as that line about truth being the half sister that doesn't forgive is sort of the idea, because now because we're living in a time when truth seems to be, and not that we're certainly not living in the first the first age of alternative facts, if
right,
you will,
right.
or malleable truth, whatever you want to
yeah.
call it. That's been around as long as,
Language.
But it almost, it seems like maybe he's saying that since truth is a half-sister, it's somebody who, it's like something that you should recognize
mm-hmm.
because it's familial to a degree.
Yeah.
But because it's not, because it's only a half sister, it's like there is a certain amount of just, like you said, unknowability.
Mm-hmm.
It's the won't forgive part that I.
Yeah, I think
that's the part that I have trouble with. Yeah.
Well, I think it dovetails with something writers, some of my mentors and fellow writers have told me, and I embrace too. And when you're doing serious writing or
mm-hmm.
serious art, I mean, truth is not necessarily ennobling
mm-hmm.
and its job is not to forgive.
Right.
Truth just is.
Right.
And I think this guy recognizes that.
Mm-hmm.
And he presents it, and truth in his case, what he observes is pretty doggone harsh.
Yeah.
So it could be that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of coda to his dark worldview.
Right. But it's perfect. It's perfect that he goes out on that. Like you said, that very last line of the she's just trying to reach you, which has a somewhat optimistic feeling to it, and then just the ridiculous nature of the story about the horse. I mean, he's saying that yes, this is the state of affairs and it is depressing, but
mm-hmm.
there's reason to laugh,
Yeah.
If only because of how absurd it is, So
and that he sings she's trying to reach you. It's actually really pretty.
Yeah.
It's not something you can say about singing
vocals,
and
vocals yeah.
of those records.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it is the aside from the only other example I can really think of is that little bit in Up the Tower where he's talking about the view out of the window,
mm-hmm.
where he's crooning. That's the only other spot I can think of where the song, his singing approaches, anything you could call pretty,
Yeah.
But I like that he'll sort of sprinkle those things throughout there, amidst the the Nick Cave stuff and the Morrissey
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
and the scat and the and some of the droning and everything. So all in all, if you were to rate it.
Homie don't rate.
when we don't rate.
Buy it.
That's right. Buy it.
It's
for
a
sure.
good record. Buy or steal it, whatever young people or people with tech savvy can
if
do.
If you're going to steal it, then.
Ryan had to burn it on the CDs for me. That will just place everything.
But if you're gonna steal it, then make sure you go. You know, if they come near you, go see them. That's for
right.
sure.
That's right.
That's always how I look at it. Because you're not. I feel
don't
like.
Steal.
I feel like you're not giving them.
No, give them some money.
Exactly. You're gonna give them more money going to see them, buying a T-shirt, buying an album there, than you're gonna. You know, what do they get? I mean, they get some stupid amount of, like 10 cents. Per whatever dollar for when it comes to records or something like that. It's ridiculous stuff.
I've mostly only sold books for almost no money.
Yeah. So do the right thing.
That's right.
But
don't prove the horse correct.
Yeah, exactly. But I would just to because I do rate stuff just because it's you know sort of a, goes along with the formality, if you will, of the podcast, but to rate it, I mean, I would give it a 9 out of 10. You know, there's very little.
Very good.
Yeah, there's very little for me to sort of nitpick with this album. I do feel like my one nitpick is that, you know, his vocals do at times, like, I feel like your average listener and even, like, your listener who's, you know, into stuff that's somewhat close to bands like Proto Martyr might find the vocals a little bit off-putting, might not be able to really give the whole album like a full listen through.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the way I feel about Bob Dylan.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Or Lou Reed,
yeah. So that's the only real nitpick I have. Sometimes I feel like if he maybe tried a few new techniques out as far as vocally, you know, it could really broaden the approach even more. Maybe he could try to throw in a little bit more melody, but it's tough. You know, it's tough because it seems like there's a pretty good balance, and like all the things that he does vocally are they're there for like a purpose, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So to mess with that balance, I feel like would be pretty risky. But I guess that's just something that will come out in time. We'll just see what happens, you know, as the band evolves. So he's certainly going to match, you know, you can tell that he's going to do vocally whatever helps music the most.
Mm-hmm.
However the music comes out, so as long as they're a band. So
I don't think he'll ever be Sinatra.
No. But we wouldn't want him to be, right? So
what did I say? I couldn't read my handwriting. You read it. It was the the love child of Morris.
Oh yeah,
and Nick Cave.
Yeah, what was it? Love child. Yep, it was Morrissey and Nick Cave. Yep.
Ryan had to decipher my own.
but I would certainly rather, you know, he's the type of vocalist that really grabs my attention, you know, and I find much more worthwhile than your run-of-the-mill singer. So,
and if you dig the early Hold Steady records, those first four records, Craig Finn is really talking a lot of those. You'll like Casey's vocals too.
So for moving from from today's Proto Martyr, from the most current, now we'll talk about their first album, which was called No Passion, All Technique, that was released in 2012. Yeah, it's quite the evolution, you know, if you look at this record and the most recent record, the one that we just talked about. And I think, Tim, you had mentioned early on after I had given you the disc that, you know, this one definitely grabbed you right away as opposed to the other one. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a straight-ahead rock and roll record, and some of the stuff I read calls these guys punk rock. There are definitely elements of punk rock in it, whatever that means, up-tempo and kind
right.
of trashy and aggressive, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, before I get into descriptive, I still think I would listen to this record before the fourth record, because it's more up the alley of where I traveled in my musical days or my band days in the 80s. And I'll just to show you how kind of I've never reviewed records officially before. So when Ryan gave me this, or you, I'm speaking to the audience, it's odd since you're not here. But I was trying to place, and I'll just read you my crazy list here. Some of it I've already mentioned. Bands I felt were somewhere in there. That was Gun Club, Nick mm-hmm. Cave, obviously, Taff, Falco, and the Panther, Burns, The Replacements, mm-hmm. Early Psychedelic Furs, like I mentioned on the other record, The Hold Steady, Trashability, mm-hmm. And you don't know what that is. I mean, The Cramps and the Leroy Brothers, Evan Johns and the H-Bombs. Then you've got that sort of southwest guitar we talked about, mm-hmm. Twangy and atmospheric and British noise, post-punk, which is pretty clear, and 80s and also Midwestern kind of art rock, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really like it. It's a very aggressive record, mm-hmm. and it's lyrically a lot more concise. Mm-hmm. Than the fourth record. That's not a plus or a negative, either of the records. They're just different in approach. Mm-hmm. But Ryan and I talked about this. This one's much more a Detroit record. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot more narrative and focus on character and place. Mm-hmm. And I guess because it's a more conventional rock record, it's more hooky as well. Mm-hmm. But I dig it. I mean, it makes me want to move around.
Yeah.
and sing along more than the other one.
Right.
But this record really features the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you should get it. I'm not going to rate it either. But
yeah,
it's I mean, if you just a couple of the, mm-hmm. the titles, you know, you got Hot Wheels City, which I would imagine, although I was too lazy to look it up, is probably mm-hmm. an old nickname for Chicago, for Detroit. But then Machinist Man, and you know, yep. being a writer, I myself write about working class people. I like that one, and mm-hmm. It's it repeats lyrics a lot about Machinist Man, Night Foreman Man, the high life. But then mm-hmm. it also, again, brings in this, this sort of feminist awareness that this guy is kind of dangerous
mm-hmm.
to women. But it also, I forget that line. Now I forget it. I didn't write it down, too. I wonder I'm on the wrong damn album. This is that one. Yeah, the line, hey, female, you better run. But it also then, there's something redemptive about this. And a literary term is it's deterministic. Mm-hmm. So he says there are things that are built into the skulls of men. And I think, again, that's part of the critique of the way society mm-hmm. is turning this guy into a kind of sexist automaton.
Yeah,
for lack of a better phrase. And then, you know, you got any album that's got a song called Feral Cats, you got to like that. And then there's the name of a bar, Jumbo's, which is, yep. There's a lot of drinking in this record.
Yeah.
And then there's also, again, some insanity. There's a song set with it, which features three characters who are all in a mental ward in Ypsilanti, mm-hmm. Michigan. But, I mean, I could talk about this record for a long time, too, but it kicks ass.
Yeah.
And I think that's about the highest praise I can can give for a record.
When you were talking about Machinist Man, I mean, that Machinist Man, for whatever reason, was like the first song that I like checked out, you know, on this record, because I was like looking at it online and looking at the song titles and going, what the hell, you know, like what's up with this band, you know? So I listened to Machinist Man first, and it was just this weird blend of, you know, post-punk. And I mean, there wasn't really like the industrial stuff so much going on at this point, but there was this weird sort of almost sense of, almost felt like a film noir, like mm-hmm. in a way that was just really weird and interesting. And that really, you know, that caught my attention. And then, I mean, you know, free supper, just the raucous nature of free supper, mm-hmm. and the as you had pointed out, the, you know, mostly unintelligible nature of Casey's vocals, yes, on a lot of these tracks, was really effective. I don't know if I want to say it was necessarily appealing to me right at first listen, but definitely, like, musically, Jumbos, that's another one that I love. Like you mentioned, Ypsilanti, I think it's pretty cool because that's like an early indication of his storytelling, mm-hmm. you know, ability. Too Many Jewels is another good one. And that one has that really cool, beat in the beginning. That's almost like a disco beat sort of.
Yeah, sort of,
in a sense, but it's then you get that really drone. It's like a droney. Mm-hmm. I think you had said reminded you of Black Sabbath.
Yeah,
the guitar riff. That's a cool mix. And another one you I think you had mentioned too about that track How He Lived After He Died. I think you.
Yeah, that's they're ruminations on mortality here. They're very mm-hmm. straight ahead, and that one's it's just a memory song,
mm-hmm.
basically, of the narrator remembering his father, who was this professorish guy who smoked a pipe, which makes him, that's sort of the professorish thing,
right.
But he lives in a house of books,
mm-hmm.
and it's this memory, and it's actually a pretty tender song,
mm-hmm.
thinking back on that. He's got another one in here, Three Swallows, and mm-hmm. it's not spelled as birds, it's swallowing again, but it's also, it also thinks of, it confronts aging some,
mm-hmm.
and then the guy can never stay completely at the literal level, which is, I think, a statement of his searching mm-hmm. intellect, and he's got this really provocative line. It says, "The great unfolding,
mm-hmm.
and wait for their arms to hold me." And I think it's interesting. You've used unfolding,
mm-hmm.
or expansion, I guess, is what you use in here. But again, there's something in that lyric that you can't completely boil down and condense. I mean, what is the great unfolding? Mm-hmm. But it's the unfolding into something larger than, you know, corporeal existence or our terrestrial existence,
mm-hmm.
and this expansion of intellect and spirituality. And so, again, even though this is more of a place-based and character narrative-driven record, you still get these philosophical flights in here that he's got in the other record. And I would imagine, you know, this... that I wouldn't in the two interceding records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he also calls Detroit the city a stray dog. That is a great metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about that line a lot after we talked before. And I mean, just how concise that is, mm-hmm. like it's incredible. It's the kind of metaphor that makes me jealous. Like,
yeah.
You know, as somebody who likes to write, you know, who has a passion for that. And like you had mentioned, that's one of the things that I find so interesting about this record too is the fact that it's rooted so much, you know, in Detroit, but yet it does, you know, at certain times it does sort of expand out, like we talked about with Ypsilanti, and just a lot of those sort of abstract images that come up, like you mentioned that line about the great unfolding. It's cool because it shows that Casey hasn't changed much as a, you know, as a lyricist, but I feel as if I feel like his confidence, you know, has grown, and I think I think he's sort of become a little bit more confident about confronting certain elements of society, maybe more head on, you know, than he did at first. And I mean that, you know, it could just be a matter of, you know, when he wrote this record, you know, his surrounding area was more, you know, immediate, you know, Detroit, and now, you know, now maybe he just has more of a panoramic view, you know, if you will, mm-hmm. of you know, the country and the world, if you will. But
I think the fourth record is more politically and philosophically expansive.
Yeah.
And more abstracted and allegorical in mm-hmm. ways. And it's also, when I think of the records, even the fourth record, even though it has these anomalies like the disco song and then the straight ahead rock and roll song, which are a little bit outside the frame of the rest of the, mm-hmm. the record, it seems to be more like an album that functions as a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the first record is more like a conventional rock and roll record that is a bunch of songs.
Mm-hmm.
It's unified again by Detroit being a place and by you know, it heavily focusing on people and having this, it's a raucous record. So I that's one of the reasons I like it. I kind of like records that don't all quite fit, all the parts don't quite fit together,
mm-hmm.
which is why, like the Replacements, Let It Be, the most outrageously titled record ever. I couldn't believe they did it. But that record is, it's a collection, it's songs, you know, they'll throw in a ballad, they'll throw in a punk rock song, they'll throw in something very serious, something really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And this, to me, harkens back to that kind of 80s music more than what people think of more as traditional post-punk, mm-hmm. which the fourth record does. I also want to bring up again, too, I'd like to know more about this guitar player. I think he cut his teeth on rockabilly.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
Yeah.
Couldn't prove that, but I believe mm-hmm. that it seems like there's some of that in the Cramps and Gun Club, some of those other bands I mentioned that, mm-hmm. That were in there.
Mm-hmm.
It adds a really cool flavor to the records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you were talking about the, you know, records that are more about different types of songs, you know, all put into, you know, this collection, like with the Replacements. Also makes me think of London Calling.
Oh yeah,
because
that's right.
London Calling definitely has that that variety of sounds. Mm-hmm. It was kind of, you know, before, you know, because then you look at what happened with what's the double disc one?
Sandinista,
yeah. Where it was like, let's really go as far as possible with this,
triple record.
That's right, triple record. I forgot.
I think London Calling's a double album. So.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, talk about. I mean, that there's an example of a band that could do that, explore all those different, you know, all those different types of sounds.
Maybe sometimes they shouldn't have done it.
Yeah. But I mean, it's
not London Calling.
I'd say more right.
One of my favorite records, as with most people who like rock and roll.
Yeah. I think it was one of those, you know, like it was like they caught lightning in a bottle that one time.
Yeah.
And then sort of maybe got in, you know, their heads got a little too big.
Smoking a lot of weed. Started the fissures in the band, too. Right. To show up.
Yeah, so it's cool, you know, but Proto Martyrs is a good example of a band who they want to expand. They want to broaden their horizons, but they also they're smart enough to, I think, to keep it. You know, keep it reined in. They're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna go too far in any one direction that, you know, you're gonna lose people.
Right.
I should say that's funny if you're gonna lose people, because if you can stay with this band, you know, that's pretty good. You know, if you can stay with this band, you know, so. But yeah, I think it's a great first record. I love the fact that, you know, this record. The fourth record and the two in between, they all have pretty distinct personalities, it's cool. I mean, I'd probably say that now that I've really listened to No Passion, All Technique and the newest one, Relatives in Descent, the most out of any of the four, like, I do think they are my favorites. And it's kind of cool to watch that evolution of the sound. Like, it's more apparent, obviously, to me now than it was when I was first listening to those records, because I didn't have a frame of reference. So, but it's cool. I mean,
you can see them coming pretty clearly. At first record, it's a bar band who's going into the studio. They don't have a lot of time and they don't have a lot of money.
Right.
And they're laying it down mostly live. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're describing, I would hear in the middle two records, but it's clear. And the fourth record is they're learning how to use the studio in different ways.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah,
it's the music is still edgy and raw, but it's processed, and they're using it. I'm trying to think of a superlative I haven't used 20 times here before. It's all those things we said in the preceding hour,
right.
5 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
We dig it, man. Yeah. Can you dig it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, right. Like you said, they're using the studio, they're taking advantage of the, you know, the things that are now, you know, at their disposal, what they can things they can do with the record. But they're doing it in a subtle enough way,
Making a bid for top 40.
Exactly. Right. Which, don't think they're going to win.
No.
So, but that's fine. That's fine.
But they're in the New York Times and on NPR. I mean,
exactly.
I don't imagine any of these guys or any of their early fans anticipated that.
Yeah. That's so. Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah. So, but, well, yeah, it makes me, makes me excited to see where the heck they go, you know. And I'm curious too, because it's like inevitably with these bands, you know, you end up with, you know, somebody has a side band, somebody does a solo thing. Like,
right.
I'd kind of be interested to see like what emerges, you know, from
maybe we get
from
a rockabilly band.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. So, and then Casey just doing, I don't know, some sort of
Moon River.
Yeah. That would be weird. So, but
singing Motown song.
Yeah. He's got the right
One Red Apple.
Casey covers Motown. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah. But all right. Well, thank you.
Are you gonna rate this one?
Oh yeah, that's right. I didn't rate it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, No Passion, All Technique. I would say I'm trying to remember what the heck Yeah, 8.5. That's what I rated it. 8.5. No, you know what? It was that I think I said originally when I listened to it,
it was a 6.5.
I was like a 6.5 or a 7, but over time, that rating definitely went up. I'd give it like an 8.5 now, or an 8.
So if you
somewhere
listen
in between
to
there,
it could go up to 11.
It could. Oh my goodness, that joke is everywhere. Like, I see it constantly. It's so funny.
But yeah,
these go to 11.
Check them out.
Yeah, definitely check out this band. I mean, if you have any sort of inkling towards, you know, punk, post-punk, just raucous music, you know, art, you know, even like art house kind of stuff, like, you know, you might even dig it, you know.
Very smart lyricist with a vision.
Exactly. Yeah, if you care about lyrical content, this is definitely something that you would dig. So
even though you'll have to read them online.
It's true.
I was born with it.
I am bored with it. Yeah. But yeah, so definitely. So yeah, newest album, Relatives in Descent, and then the other album is No Passion, All Technique from 2012. So definitely get those. And there's two other albums too, so check those out. You know, it's not a huge amount of music. It's not gonna take you, you know, it's not gonna take you a day to listen to it. You know, these albums are all about 40 minutes or so. So it's not a huge amount of material, but. But
give them a chance, especially the fourth record. It took me a while to get it.
Yeah. Which I'm always amazed that that can still happen.
Yeah.
You know, like, just because, you know, it's like we're at a point where you feel like, you know, everything, feel like everything's been done before.
Yeah.
So when somebody can really, you know, come across with a record that, that you kind of have to wrap your head around and work at it. That's pretty amazing to me. So.
All right, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you for doing that. I'm going to make sure I properly exit out this time. So.
Yeah. I mean, well, you were talking about ethereal earlier. That's where the first.
It's somewhere in the cloud.
Up there chiming.
Right. Maybe if I ever find it, you know.
Boring an angel.
Yeah. That's it.
Or a devil.
Oh, goodness. All right, everybody. Well, that concludes this episode of Radio Live Transmission Podcast. I didn't even do this last time, I remember. Like, we just stopped talking, and I was like, boom, gone. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Tim, for doing this again. And
come see the Irascibles January 7th at Cafe 9. Although you won't have this edited by January 7th.
Oh, I will.
Okay.
Yeah.
January Where is 7th, it at? 8:30, Cafe 9, New Haven.
In New Haven.
Reunion of my garage pop band from Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, if anybody, anybody that's close, anybody that's in the area, please come out, check it out. So that'd be a lot of fun. So
it will be.
Yeah. So.
I'm good looking.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Alrighty, well, this is Ryan and Tim signing off. We'll catch you guys later.